Chapter 3. Stepping Stones. In June, the rainy season began. The grey clouds came rolling up from the plains, first of all infiltrating the valley of the Teesta in loose, detached masses, then moving in across the hills in a solid wall of rain that at times blotted out the entire landscape. For days on end, Mount Kanchenjunga could not be seen. Instead, even when the sky cleared, there was only thick white cloud piled up against the horizon. Though the rain fell heavily enough at times, the rainy season was much less severe in the hills than in the plains. In between the downpours, the sun was hot and bright, and the sky intensely blue, though the thick white cloud hardly ever moved aside to reveal the snows of Mount Kanchenjunga sparkling through the rain-washed air. It was my fourth year in India. Already I had learnt to love the rainy season. I loved the heavy drumming sound of the rain on the roof. I loved the sense of green things thirstily drinking up the rain and growing as they did so. Above all, I loved the way in which the rain insulated one from the rest of the world, weaving around one a silver-grey cocoon of silence within which one could sit hour after hour and quietly muse. No wonder the Buddha had advised his monks not to wander about during the rainy season, but to remain in one place, whether in a mountain cave, a woodland shrine, or a shed at the bottom of somebody's garden. No wonder that rainy season had come to be regarded in the course of centuries as a time of spiritual retreat, a time of more intensive study of the scriptures and more intensive practice of meditation. The Dharmodaya Vihara was an excellent place in which to spend the rainy season, but for me it had one disadvantage. Though I could get on with my study and meditation there easily enough, I still had to go out on my arms round each day, and I still had to go at a certain time. Had I gone earlier, food would not have been ready, and had I gone later, there might not have been any left. Sometimes it was raining at this time, sometimes it was not. Once or twice it was raining so heavily that my thin cotton robes were saturated in a couple of minutes, and I returned to the vihara soaked to the skin. Nucha Bahadur saw this and undertook to do something about it. From the time we first met, he had been a regular visitor to the Vihara, and especially after his election as secretary of the YMBA, I came to rely on him in a number of ways. He was my main source of information about the religious practices of the Buddhist Niwas. From him I learnt that Niwa boys were initiated into the cult of one or another of the more esoteric tantric deities, usually without understanding what it was all about, and that they were supposed thereafter to perform the ritual worship of the deity every day. Some of the older Niwas actually did this. The majority, like Nietzsche himself, gave up the practice after a few years or even after a few months. Niwa boys were also initiated into the Buddhist monastic order by married Vajracharyas. Heads shaved and clad in yellow robes, for 3 days they lived as monks, going for alms each day to the houses of relatives and friends, who fed them sumptuously, Nietzsche said, and taking no solid food after midday. At the end of the period they returned to their preceptor, confessed that they found the life of a monk much too hard to bear, and asked to be released from their vows. Niwa girls underwent an even stranger ceremony. They were married to the fruit of a bell tree, a tree which in Hindu tradition is sacred to the god Shiva. This meant that no Niwa woman ever became a widow, her true husband being always living. Nucha himself, though by birth a Vajracharya, had little sympathy for the practices he described, seeing in them only signs of educational backwardness, and being convinced that they were destined to disappear with the spread of modern knowledge, as indeed they probably were. For him, the very fact that he could be a Vajracharya while knowing nothing of the Vajrayana proved beyond all doubt that there was something radically wrong with the traditional Buddhism of Nepal. In his view, education, modern English education, was the only remedy, and he was hoping to set up an English boarding school for boys in Nepal. Meanwhile, he was a highly efficient secretary and helped me in as many ways as he could. Having seen that it was not easy for me to go out on my daily alms round during the rainy season, he went and collected enough money from the Buddhists of Kalimpong to support me for that period. Altogether, he collected 140 rupees. For the second time since my arrival in Kalimpong, the solution of one problem only resulted in the creation of another. Nutcha absolutely insisted on handing over the money he had collected to me personally, so that I should be free to spend it on whatever I wished, whenever I wished. This put me in a quandary. For 2 years or more, I had not touched money. Not to touch gold or silver was indeed one of the 10 Shramanera precepts, and I wanted to go on observing it, even though, as I well knew, it was nowadays honoured much more in the breach than in the observance. Indeed, the fact that others did not observe the precept seemed all the more reason why I should observe it. However, Nietzsche's good deed had put him in a quandary too. In Kalimpong, as elsewhere in India, there were only too many people who went round collecting money for this or for that worthy cause, and who then, on one pretext or another, pocketed most of it themselves. If Nutcha was to take care of the 140 rupees and spend it from it on my account as necessary, which is what I wanted him to do, he might well be accused of doing this kind of thing. After all, he had made enemies among the Newars by his outspokenness, and he was also without regular work. In the end, with the greatest reluctance, I allowed Nutcha to count out the dirty notes and dull coins into my hand. How strange it was to be handling money again. How strange even the simplest monetary transaction felt. Indeed, the whole business of going into a shop, asking for what one wanted, then handing over in exchange certain bits of paper and metal, seemed extraordinarily clumsy, artificial, and unnatural, even slightly absurd, and it was several weeks before I became accustomed to it all. Reluctant as I was to handle money again, the change from the economics of the begging bowl to the economics of the marketplace was not without its advantages. It was not simply that I no longer had to go out on my alms round during the rainy season. Though Tilakdari had returned to Bihar, my begging bowl still had to go on supporting more than one person. Indeed, by the time Nutcha Bahadur handed over to me the money he had collected, its capacities were being stretched to the limit, and I was beginning to wish I had been given one of those giant, well-lacquered Burmese bowls that were capable of holding enough food for half a dozen people. Besides Anthony Ellen Dimitan, I had two young English travellers staying with me at the Vihara, and several other visitors would be turning up before long. Some of them were able to support themselves. Others turned up penniless, or very nearly so, and had to be provided for. In the circumstances, it was more convenient to be able to buy provisions than to have to distribute the contents of my begging bowl. Anthony Ellen Dimitan stayed with me for only 2 or 3 weeks. His original intention was to help me organise the YMBA, but he spent most of his time in his room banging out articles on his portable typewriter. I had read two books by him a couple of years before. One was on Rabindranath Tagore, the greatest figure in modern Bengali, perhaps in modern Indian literature, while the other was on Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose, the founder of the so-called Indian National Army. Both books were written in a sort of rhythmic prose and were couched in the most pompous and grandiloquent style imaginable. The style was indeed the man. Some months later, I took Anthony Ellen Dimitan as the model for a pen portrait of the sort of person who mistakes concepts for realities and who is unable to distinguish between the state of emotional intoxication with the idea of helping others and actually feeling love for them and helping them. Quote, "Not long ago, a gentleman was introduced to us who professed, with almost every other breath he drew, that his sole mission in life was to, quote, serve humanity, unquote. He spoke several languages fluently, had read widely in both Eastern and Western philosophy and religion, was a not unpracticed journalist, and above all else was quite sincere in his professions. Grandiose schemes for the regeneration of humanity and for the amelioration of the lot of the Indian masses, together with the wildest generalizations and most impractically altruistic sentiments imaginable, quote, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, flowed from his lips in an unending stream. He did his best to appear overwhelmed with work and flew from one organization to another as a startled bird flies from tree to tree. After meeting him twice or thrice and having on each occasion fruitlessly endeavored to elicit from him an unambiguous statement of what he truly believed and what he really was trying to accomplish, and having always found that it was his habit, when thus interrogated, to beat a hasty retreat behind a cloud of the most vapid generalities possible, much as a lamp-scared squid disappears into the darkness of its own effluvia, we concluded that he had completely lost the earth touch of what are conventionally termed realities, and was floundering his bewildered way through a cloud cuckoo land of his own imagination, a realm of meaningless abstractions wherein he had by that time become completely lost. We were therefore hardly astonished when we found that none of his schemes had ever borne fruit, and that, despite the loftiness of his ideal of universal service, he had never succeeded in being of practical use to a single one of his fellow men, in even the most ordinary and insignificant manner. Perpetually excited, invariably in a hurry, vaporing advice with the smuggest assumption of spiritual authority, he thrusts upon our notice a striking illustration of the fate that can befall the sincerest spiritual aspirant even, who forgets that he has not to love and serve some unreal abstraction, whether humanity or any other conceptual symbol, the mind's own creation, but the concrete individual men and women whom we see living and working and suffering round us every day of our lives. End of quote. This was perhaps rather strong, at least as regards Anthony Ellen Jimmerton. He must have irritated me considerably. Perhaps I did not make sufficient allowance for the fact that, as an ex-Roman Catholic and an ex-priest, he would never say what his ecclesiastical status actually was. He was in a state of chronic mental and emotional confusion. Like others in the same position, he was in fact floundering his way through religious universalism and romantic nationalism towards some kind of social work. The two young English travellers were Leslie Turner and Donald Hofford. Though knowing nothing of the languages of most of the countries through which they passed, they had made the journey from London to Gangtok without mishap, travelling by road, by rail, and on foot, and meeting everywhere with kindness and hospitality, even in places which they had been warned by the authorities were unfriendly. In Gangtok, they had pitched their tent on the palace lawn. Princess Pema Tsetjian, who was then in Sikkim, gave them a note to me, and that was how they came to be staying with me at the Dharmodya Vihara. Leslie Turner was blonde, burly, and placid. Donald Hofford, thin, dark, and intense. Neither of them was interested in Buddhism, though towards the end of their journey through Afghanistan, they had taken the trouble of going to see the enormous rock Buddhas of Bamiyan, the largest of which was over 150 feet high. In the course of a talk given as part of our regular Sunday lecture series, Donald Hofford gave a vivid description of the Valley of Bamiyan and of the colossal Buddhas standing sentinel at the bottom of the cliff. Like Anthony Elendimitan, the two travellers did not stay at the Vihara long. This was just as well, probably because they had been in each other's company day and night for more than 3 months. There was quite a lot of tension between them, and this sometimes resulted in vicious squabbles. Major Joseph E. Can, or Upasaka Joseph E. Can, as he preferred to be styled, was not only interested in Buddhism, but even more intense than Donald Hofford. Swale had met him the previous year in Lucknow, where he had settled after the war, and where he had become the president of the local branch of the Bengal Buddhist Association. Thinking that, as the YMBA expanded, we would need more full-time workers, my organisationally minded friend has suggested that he should invite him up to Kalimpong to join us, and to this I readily agreed. Soon afterwards, the Upasaka arrived and was given a room at the Vihara. Since he was drawing an army pension, as Swale also was, his presence did not impose any additional strain on my slender resources. On the contrary, from the very first, he contributed generously, even lavishly, to the expenses of our little establishment. Though neither of us then knew it, indeed it was not even possible for us to think in such terms, he was to stay in Kalimpong for very much longer than Swale, and even for longer than me. Throughout the whole of his stay, however, he would never admit to any other age than the one he put down on his YMBA membership form on his arrival, quote, over 50. In appearance, Joe, as he liked to be called, was of medium height and build, with hair rather longer than Swale's and more silver than brown. His most extraordinary feature were his eyes, which had a haunted look and stared out from a white, haggard face with alarming intensity. When speaking, he constantly crossed and uncrossed his legs, like a schoolgirl who wants to go to the toilet but is afraid to ask, while from time to time he let out a high-pitched, nervous cackle that ended, more often than not, in a kind of screech. Nervousness was indeed Joe's outstanding characteristic, and I was not surprised to find that, as his nicotine-stained fingers indicated, he was an inveterate chain-smoker. The clothes he wore were of American make, obviously quite expensive, and both rather too big for him and rather too young. The reason for this I learned later. And when he went out, he either wore a light blue Homburg hat or carried a multicoloured golf umbrella. Despite his almost Cockney accent, Joe was in fact in many ways more American than English. Part of his early life had indeed been spent in Canada, though he gave no details and was altogether more reluctant to talk about his family and professional background than Swale, apparently, was to talk about his. About his immediate background, he was more communicative. In Lucknow, he lodged with an Anglo-Indian, that is, Eurasian, Christian family, who refused to take his Buddhism seriously and were always trying to persuade him to accompany them to church. He himself took his Buddhism very seriously indeed, up to a point, though I never succeeded in learning from him how or on what grounds he had become a Buddhist. There were two Buddhist viharas in Lucknow, one belonging to the local branch of the Bengal Buddhist Association, the other to the Mahabodhi Society, though in neither case was the legal position really so straightforward as these words suggest. Joe was more closely associated with the Bodhisattva Vihara, as the Bengali Vihara was called. Formerly there had been much conflict between the two Viharas, but thanks to Joe's efforts, peace had been restored, and they now worked together harmoniously for the advancement of Buddhism in Lucknow. The founder and presiding genius of the Buddhist temple, as the Mahabodhi Society's Vihara was called, was a redoubtable ex-Brahmin monk of Bengali origin named Bodhinanda Mahastavira, about whom I had already heard from Kashyapji. Bodhidananda's policy was to make Theravada Buddhism acceptable to the non-Buddhist Indian layman by providing him with a complete set of samskaras, or domestic rituals, on the orthodox Hindu model, with verses from the Pali scriptures instead of Sanskrit Vedic mantras, and Buddhist monks taking the place of Hindu Brahmins. There were, as I saw in the thick Hindi book he had compiled, rituals for birth, rituals for taking one's first rice, rituals for piercing the ears, for earrings, rituals for commencing one's studies, rituals for marriage, and rituals for death. There are rituals for every conceivable stage and activity of human existence. It was also the old monk's policy, Kashyapji had explained, to encourage Sinhalese Buddhist men living and working in Lucknow to marry local girls instead of importing their brides from Ceylon. What is there so wonderful about these Sinhalese girls, he would ask? Are their private parts made of gold? Marry Indian girls and produce some good Indian upasakas who will look after me in my old age. Joe had an amusing story of his own to tell about Bodhidananda Mahasthavira. On calling at the Buddhist temple one morning, he had found the old man sitting beneath an enormous full-length portrait of himself, evidently a recent acquisition. The head of the portrait was surrounded by a halo. Slowly, Joe looked from Bodhidananda to the portrait, then from the portrait back to Bodhidananda, and at length said, "I don't see any halo." "My devotees put it in," explained the old monk, not without irritation. "You vain old man," Joe screeched indignantly. "You had it put in yourself." Perhaps there really was a halo around the old monk's head, for he died not long afterwards, full of years and honours, and was cremated by his devotees with all due ceremony. Besides restoring peace between the two viharas, Joe had also restored peace within the Bodhisattva vihara itself, where two factions of Bengali Buddhists were fighting for control of the place. He'd been able to restore peace there, however, only at a price, the price being that the Major Saheb himself should assume the presidency of the local branch of the Bengal Buddhist Association, to which the vihara belonged, and in this way preserve the balance between the two factions and prevent either of them from dominating the vihara's affairs. So far, the arrangement had worked quite well, though Joe soon found that the president was also expected to be the principal donor. Most of the two or three dozen members of the association were poorly paid cooks and bearers, working either for high-ranking government officers or in big European-style hotels. As the pampered lodger in an Anglo-Indian Christian family and the respected leader of the local Bengali Buddhist community, Joe was in Lucknow a comparatively big fish in a comparatively small pond. In Kalimpong, the pond was a bigger pond, and the fish, therefore, a proportionately smaller fish. It was this fact that was partly responsible for Joe's extreme nervousness, though it was easy to see that he would be nervous in almost any situation. One tangible result of his association with the Bengali Buddhists was that he was well drilled in orthodox Theravada manners and customs, particularly in those relating to the treatment of monks, and this certainly made it less difficult for him to adapt to life at the Dharmodaya Vihara than might otherwise have been the case. Despite the sharpness of his reaction to Bodhidananda's halo, Joe was in fact most punctilious in paying his respects to the yellow robe, and always did so with full traditional ceremony. Though his behaviour later underwent a change, this was only after he'd been in Kalimpong for some length of time, and had seen, perhaps, how ordinary monks, that is, monks who were not incarnate lamas, were treated by Tibetan Buddhists, especially by members of the aristocracy. Meanwhile, the question was, what was he to do in Kalimpong? Swale has suggested in his letter that Joe might help with administrative work, but of this kind of work there was as yet very little to be done. I myself thought he might help by doing some lecturing and perhaps collaborate on the various literary projects we had in mind, on one of which, in fact, I was already working. Joe had not been long in Kalimpong, however, before it became obvious that he would not be of much use in either of these fields. The preparation of a short talk threw him into agonies of anxiety. While his spelling and grammar were distinctly shaky, he had no idea how to construct a sentence. However much he might be able to help with the work of the YMBA, it was clearly not going to be through giving lectures and collaborating on literary projects. Something else would have to be found for him to do. The literary project on which I was already working was that of a monthly magazine of Himalayan religion, culture, and education. It would not just be another scholarly publication, but a journal of living Buddhism. It would be imbued with the all-embracing spirit of the Mahayana and would include articles on the Buddhist traditions of Tibet, of Sikkim, of Bhutan, and of Nepal. There would be poetry and short stories, extracts from the great Mahayana sutras, and news of YMBA activities. We would send it out not only all over the district, but all over India, all over the world. Thus, above the beautiful iridescent ball that was the idea of the YMBA, there hovered a second ball, in some ways even more beautiful and iridescent than the first, a ball that would send out even more brilliant flashes and be seen even further afield. This second ball, too, was invited to descend, and in the month of July, either shortly before or shortly after Joe's arrival, the monthly magazine Stepping Stones came into existence. Friends subsequently persuaded me that Stepping Stones with a hyphen was the more correct form, so from the third issue onwards the name was hyphenated. In format, the magazine was a 20-page octavo with cream-coloured wrappers printed in red ink. On the front cover was a Tibetan block print of the Buddha delivering his first discourse to the five ascetics in the deer park at Sarnath, near Benares, and below this the contents. The principal contents were two articles and a short story. Perhaps predictably, the first article was by Dr. Rurich, and perhaps equally predictably, it was on the celebrated mantra Om Mani Padme Hum. Since my first meeting with Dr. Rurich, I had seen him several times, and he had not only given a Sunday afternoon lecture on the introduction of Buddhism into Tibet, but had agreed to be one of the office bearers of the YMBA with the title of advisor, though on the clear understanding that he would not be expected to do any organisational work. Each time I saw him, he was wearing riding boots and breeches, and whenever I visited him at Crookety, I was conscious of the same tremendous downward pressure coming from the room overhead, as on my first visit. The first of these mysteries was cleared up more quickly than the second. In the course of his travels in Tibet and Mongolia, Rurich's father, Nicholas Rurich, had been told of ancient prophecies relating to the coming of Maitreya, the future Buddha. These prophecies had impressed him deeply, and he had come to believe that the coming of Maitreya was imminent, and that it would be preceded by certain events of world-shaking significance, in which he and his family would play an important role. George Rurich, it seemed, shared this belief. The most important of the events preceding Maitreya's advent was the appearance of the King of Shambhala. This mysterious personage would come riding forth from his hidden kingdom in the heart of Central Asia, accompanied by a host of warriors on horseback, and would conquer the whole earth. Those who wanted to help prepare the way for the coming of Maitreya
must be ready to ride with the King of Shambhala and his men. He might appear at any minute. They must be prepared to mount and ride. They must always be booted and spurred. Though I never discussed his father's beliefs with Dr. Rurich, and had no idea how literally the distinguished Tibetologist took these prophecies, or to what extent his father had enlarged upon them, there was no doubt that Nicholas Rurich had announced the coming of Maitreya in numerous articles and poems, and had also made it the subject of some remarkable paintings. There was no doubt either that George Rurich was always booted, even if not spurred. Whether or not this meant that he was actually waiting to ride with the King of Shambhala, he passed his time, quietly enough, working on his translation of The Blue Annals and acting as advisor to the YMBA. The second of our two main articles was by Prince Peter of Greece and dealt with polyandry in Tibet. This was appropriate in a way, as Prince Peter lived practically next door to Rurich, in an even bigger example of the Himalayan mock Tudor style of architecture, and had also given a Sunday afternoon lecture for us on, quote, Western Tibet. He was, in fact, a well-known anthropologist and specialised in the study of polyandrous people. A tall, well-built man in his early 40s, already beginning to go bald, he mixed easily with all sections of Kalimpong society, from the coolies and the beggars to the aristocracy, and was well-liked on account of his unassuming, friendly behaviour. The short story that came in between the two main articles was by Swale, entitled Are You Sure? It featured, perhaps rather unfortunately, a haunted Tibetan gompa and a talking figure of the Buddha. Joe subsequently made much of the fact that the Buddha figure, speaking to the hero of the story, who clearly represented Swale himself, said, You've been a long time in gaining the summit, and I have been waiting for you. Your path has been long and steep, full of pitfalls at times, but you have made it at last. According to Joe, Swale was nowhere near the summit, and whatever the pitfalls might have been, was guilty of the grossest presumption in claiming that he had made it at last. Be that as it may, Swale was an inveterate writer of short stories, some of which, he averred, had been published in Blackwood's, and on this occasion may have allowed his imagination to run away with him. In addition to the articles by Dr. Rurich and Prince Peter and the short story by Swale, our first stepping stones contained some sayings of Milarepa, taken from Tibet's great yogi Milarepa, and some precepts of the gurus, taken from Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, as well as two poems by me, an editorial which came at the front of the magazine, and a news and notes section which came at the back. Like the haiku I had written earlier, and was still writing, each of the poems reflected images drawn from my immediate surroundings. One of them was quite short, consisting of only two verses, the other rather longer. The first poem was entitled Simply Mountains, the second Messengers from Tibet. I must have thought quite highly of Messengers from Tibet, for a few years later I made it the title poem of a small collection of poems. At any rate, I composed it in a mood of unusually intense inspiration. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The sun was shining brightly. Swale and I were walking in the direction of Bong Busti, which lay on the other side of the ridge, below the development area. We were on our way to see Mr. Shen, the headmaster of the Chinese school. Suddenly, the first verse of the poem came into my mind, then the second, and then slowly, at much longer intervals, the rest of the verses. I hardly saw Mr. Shen. I hardly heard what he and Swale were saying. I hardly knew what I was saying myself. As in a dream, I was conscious of verses struggling one by one into my mind, and being helped to emerge undamaged from wherever it was they came. By the time we returned to the Dharmodya Vihara, the poem was complete, and I wrote it down. The editorial and the notes and news section were both written by me. I had constituted myself the editor of Stepping Stones, while Swale printed and published it on behalf of the YMBA. In the editorial, I struck what I hoped would be an unambiguously spiritual note. I spoke of the way, and of the Buddha's discovery of the three great stepping stones of moral conduct, meditation, and transcendental wisdom, by leaping from one to another of which a man could safely cross over the raging torrent of desire, hatred, and delusion, and reach the further shore of enlightenment, which is also compassion and perfect bliss. Seeing that men were running more blindly than ever up and down the hither shore, our little magazine sought, I declared, to draw the attention of the modern world to those great stepping stones which the Buddha had discovered. But producing stepping stones involved much more than collecting articles and stories and writing editorials. There were printers to be found, galleys and page proofs to be read, papers to be selected, illustrations to be chosen, and advertisements to be procured, not to mention subscribers. In the first issue of Stepping Stones, there were two full-page advertisements. Guy and Jyoti, who of course was treasurer of the YMBA, took the inside back cover for Jyoti Brothers, while a young Mawari well-wisher took the outside back cover for his own firm. When the advertisements appeared, I was dismayed to find that both of them featured musk, which was an animal product, and one of the three principal exports from Tibet to India, the other two being yak tails and wool. Yak tails were used for making the fly whisks waved in Hindu ritual worship. The inside front cover was taken by a Lahore publishing concern in which Swale had some kind of interest. Or rather, we gave them the space, the advertisement being one of the unpaid variety. Announced as, quote, out shortly, were Smile a While, a book of lyrics in lighter vein by Swale, and, quote, The Introduction of Buddhism into Tibet, unquote, by Dr. George Rurich. Neither of these publications ever appeared. The second of them, of course, comprised Dr. Rurich's lecture of the previous month, and the question of its publication had already given me some trouble. Indeed, it was responsible for the most unpleasant experience I had yet had in Kalimpong. Among those present at the lecture had been Suresh Chandra Jain, a tall, portly Bihari in his late 30s. He was a well-known figure in Kalimpong, being the manager of the Himalayan store, the town's principal emporium, a member of the municipal council, and editor of the Himalayan Times, a paper which described itself as, quote, the only English weekly serving Tibet, Bhutan, Sikkim, the Darjeeling Hills, tea gardens, and duars. He had apparently attended in his editorial capacity. After the meeting, he approached Dr. Rurich for permission to publish the lecture in his paper. Dr. Rurich referred him to me, saying that he had already handed the manuscript over to me for publication in the YMBA. The wily Jain therefore approached me. Would I mind lending him the manuscript for a few days, so that he could write a short summary of the lecture for the Himalayan Times? Nothing loath, I at once agreed. Distrusting the man's oily manner, however, I stipulated that the summary should be very short, and that it should not include any verbatim extracts from a lecture. Oh yes, it would be very short, purred Jain. A few days later I heard, quite by chance, that the whole lecture had been set up in type and was about to be printed. Thinking that there must have been a mistake, I went to see Suresh Babu. Oh no, he assured me, the lecture was not being printed. All that was being printed was a short summary, just as he had promised me. The following afternoon, the brother of a YMBA member, who worked as a compositor in the Himalayan Times Press, came to the Vihara with an urgent message. The lecture had been set up in type and was being printed that very evening. If I wanted to do anything about it, I must act quickly. Once again, I went to see Jain. This time, he did not deny that the lecture had been set up in type. Dr. Rowich had given him permission to publish it, he told me smoothly. I at once telephoned Rowich. No, said the Tibetologist in astonishment, he had not given any such permission. In fact, he had not spoken to Jain since the day of the meeting. Back then again to Jain I went, having first taken the precaution of asking Rowich to telephone Jain and confirm that he did not have his permission to publish the lecture. Once again Jain insisted that he did have Rowich's permission. Had Rowich not telephoned him then? No, he had not. This meant another telephone call to Rowich. Yes, he had telephoned Jain, the Tibetologist told me, unable to understand what was going on. Not only that, Jain had assured him that the lecture had not been set up in time and that he would not be publishing it. There was now nothing for it but to have a showdown with Jain. He was not at the Himalayan store. Eventually I tracked him down at a small office he had recently opened at the entrance to the high street and called him out into the road. You are nothing but a liar, I told him, as his face purpled with indignation. Nothing but a dirty, despicable liar. And ignoring his splutterings, I continued in this strain for several minutes. What made matters worse from his point of view was that four or five of his employees were standing in the doorway behind him, grinning broadly, and apparently by no means averse to hearing their lord and master being taken to task in this unceremonious fashion. As I might have expected, Jain took his revenge. Before the rainy season was out, he had spread round the bazaar the story that I was a communist spy. 5 or 6 years later, he died tragically in a motor car accident. Long before his death, the breach between us had been more or less repaired. But the story of my being a communist spy lingered on, and in the politically sensitive state of the border area, this did me no good. End of chapter 3.